My name is Lisa, and I'm an alcoholic. This is an open meeting of the Atlanta Group of Alcoholics Anonymous, and all are welcome to attend. It is our belief that our meeting structure is necessary to maintain the integrity of the group so that it may better carry the message of AA. And since the most important aspect of AA recovery is one alcoholic relating to another, only alcoholics may participate. If your primary problem is other than alcoholism, we think it will also be helpful for you to contact an anonymous organization which more specifically deals with your addiction. Our literature person, Destina and Coble, have the list of such groups with their phone numbers. In any case, we hope that you learn here. In any case, we hope that what you learn here may be helpful to your recovery and your understanding. Susan S. will read the preamble.
Hi, everybody. I'm an alcoholic. My name is Susan. Hi. Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of men and women who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other that they may solve their common problem and help others to recover from alcoholism. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. There are no dues or fees for AA membership. We are self-supporting through our own contributions. AA is not allied with any sect, denomination, politics, organization, or institution, does not wish to engage in any controversy, neither endorses nor opposes any causes. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and help other alcoholics to achieve sobriety. Thank you.
Dennis C. will read the steps.
My name is Dennis Corona. I'm an alcoholic. Hi. The 12 steps. One, we admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable. Two, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. Three, made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood him. Four, made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. Five, admitted to God, to ourselves, and to another human being the exact nature of our wrongs. Six, were entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. Seven, humbly asked him to remove our shortcomings. Eight, made a list of all persons we had harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. Nine, made direct amends to such persons wherever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. 10, continued to take personal inventory, and when we were wrong, promptly admitted it. 11, sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understood him, praying only for knowledge of his will for us and the power to carry that out. 12, having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps, we tried to carry this message to alcoholics and to practice these principles in all our affairs.
Please join in a serenity prayer. God, grant me the serenity. Maria D. will read the traditions.
Hi, I'm Maria. I'm an alcoholic. Okay, the 12 traditions. One. Our common welfare should come first. Personal recovery depends upon AA unity. Two, for our group purpose, there is but one ultimate authority, a loving God, as he may express himself in our group conscience. Our leaders are but trusted servants. They do not govern. Three, the only requirement for AA membership is a desire to stop drinking. 4. Each group should be autonomous except in matters affecting other groups or AA as a whole. 5. Each group has but one primary purpose, to carry its message to the alcoholic who still suffers. 6. An AA group ought never endorse, finance, or lend the AA name to any related facility or outside enterprise, lest problems of money, property, and prestige divert us from our primary purpose. 7. Every AA group ought to be fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions. 8. Alcoholics Anonymous should remain forever non-professional, but our service centers may employ special workers. 9. AA as such ought never be organized, but we may create service boards or committees directly responsible to those they serve. 10. Alcoholics Anonymous has no opinion on outside issues. Hence, the AA name ought never be drawn into public controversy. 11. Our public relations policy is based on attraction rather than promotion. We need always maintain personal anonymity at the level of press, radio, and films. 12. Anonymity is the spiritual foundation of all our traditions, ever reminding us to place principles before personalities.
The format of this meeting is 2 10-minute speakers followed by an information break, then our main speaker who will speak for 30 minutes. Our first 10-minute speaker is Mike S.
Hi, my name is Mike and I am an alcoholic. Just want to thank you, Chris, for asking me to speak. I find it to be an honor and a privilege to be alive and a member of Alcoholics Anonymous today because, as far as I'm concerned, I should be dead. You know, before the meeting today, we were, a group of friends and I were going over steps 10, 11, and 12. And if you're new, I didn't walk into these rooms with a group of friends. You know, I don't know how it happened. I mean, I could try to explain it to you, but it's really on the basis of my relationship with a power greater than myself. And it's really that simple because I have nothing else besides that. What it was like, I grew up in a very strict household, and my parents were not alcoholics. They never drank around us. And, you know, I just grew up with a sense of not belonging, like not knowing, you know, where I fit into this world. You know, I always thought that people had it more together than I did. I always felt that for me to match their lives or their manageability, I had to be perfect. And for me to be perfect is just, it's not possible, you know. And, you know, I was always chasing after something that just wasn't possible. And, you know, it just threw me basically into a pit of despair because I had no foundation for life. You know, I had religion, you know, and what religion gave me was a basic framework for what I call my higher power today. But, you know, I like my higher power much better now than I did then. You know, and when I started drinking, it was, you know, I was chasing that same thing, you know, trying to chase that thing that was unattainable. You know, I got it after that not first drink, I wouldn't say after, but after the first drunk, I felt that sense of belonging and that, you know, that I fit into this world, and from then on, I chased it. I chased it to the ends of the earth, and I never got it again. And it led to all sorts of unmanageability. My, you know, normal drinkers could have like 2 or 3 drinks, and then they say, you know, I'm drunk. I think I'm going to stop. You know, that confused me. When someone said they were going to stop, it really made me angry at the first part because how dare you stop drinking in front of me? You know, I came here to drink. I came here to get drunk. You can't stop drinking. And it was really just, it just didn't make any sense to me. Normal drinkers, like I said, have 2 or 3 drinks and go home. You know, I drank and I woke up in a trunk of a car, you know. Normal drinkers don't do that. That was, you know, I blacked out a whole lot, you know. I went to, you know, I didn't start drinking until later on in high school, and in the beginning it was manageable. You know, I was, you know, I wasn't getting in trouble. I could talk to women. I could do all sorts of things. But you know, then came college, and all bets were off after college because I was free. You know, I didn't have to basically be accountable to anybody, and you know, I went to a college in the Bronx called the Maritime Academy, and you know, I didn't learn anything there except how to drink. And you know, what I found out in the Bronx is that there are these things called bodegas. And if you were at the Sunday night meeting, you heard Amanda share about this. But you know, that was my source of fuel was were basically 40-ounce beers, and I like 64s better because they had more in it. And you know, I only had to buy two or three of them. And you know, again, normal drinkers don't buy two or three 64 ounces of malt liquor and expect to finish them in one night. Also, you know, the unmanageability of my drinking led me to not eating. You know, I figured I'll just drink instead of eat because, you know, I don't have the money to eat, so I'll just drink. And in Bill's story, he says how he was 40 pounds underweight. I wouldn't say I was 40 pounds, but I was basically a skeleton. And I didn't think anything was wrong. I thought this is what you did. This is how people drink. You know, you just go out and you get blasted. And that was the basis of my life for a long, long time. And you know, I decided I didn't want to go to college anymore. So I failed out. You know, beyond my parents' consent, and you know, because they wouldn't let me leave. So I just took matters into my own hand and. And I went into the workforce, and what I do for a living is, you know, I do repairs on elevators. And to be drunk and to be fixing elevators at the same time isn't a very good idea. But that's what I did. You know, I would stand on top of elevators spinning, basically. And, you know, by this point, I was just suicidal. I wanted to die, and but I was just too afraid to do it. And the only thing that would stop me... Thank you. The only thing that would stop me from that is booze. Booze stopped me from killing myself a lot of times. And I'll just quickly, you know, when I was out there, I didn't believe in humanity. I thought humanity was God's greatest mistake. And I thought that humanity didn't have the capacity to love. But the one thing that did, that I thought made up for it was animals. And I always had pets. And one night I decided that it was more important for me to drink than to take care of an animal. And it was a hot August night, and, you know, thunderstorms were coming, and the dog was going crazy, and I decided I needed to drink. So, you know, cut it short, the dog, you know, died of heat stroke. And that's when it hit me. Something's wrong. You know, it had to take a death of a living thing for me to be like, oh, well, maybe I have a problem with my drinking. But that didn't stop me. I drank for a couple more weeks, and by the grace of God, I got in contact with someone who was in the rooms, and I went to my first meeting. My first meeting was the 11:30 morning meeting of the Mustard Seed, and, you know, Jim spoke here a few weeks ago, talked about how, you know, when you walk into an AA room, you know, one of the slogans, I think he said, should be, the war's over, you lost. You know, and that's how I felt when I walked into the Mustard Seed, because, you know, it's a dark room, and there's the steps and traditions, and I'm like, what happened? How did, you know, how did this happen? But I knew deep down in my heart that I just couldn't do it anymore. I was finished. And I knew if I went back out, I probably wouldn't come back. You know, and I got a sponsor in the Atlantic Group, and his name was Raphael. He moved down to Florida, and I'm forever grateful to him because he took me through the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. And, you know, he helped me clear away the wreckage of the past. And, you know, that is essential for me. You know, if you're new and this is all sounding weird, you know, just stay here. You'll get there. The most, you know, I need to keep my side of the street clean today so that I can have a relationship with God. And it comes down to that. And that's it. I go to meetings. You know, I do lots of service because... you know, the only way I got to know people was by doing service. I didn't, you know, I have very limited social skills. And, you know, doing service helped me break through that. And Chris will attest to this. You know, I had about 10 days, and I went to the Atlantic Group picnic. And, you know, people were not a thing that I wanted to be around. So there was definitely a tree there that was my best friend. You know, I just hung on to that tree for dear life for a good hour. And I was, you know, that was a lot for me. You know, I couldn't be around people. But today I have such a beautiful network of people around me. And Kevin H. spoke here a few months ago speaking. He said how... you know, there are, you know, you're going to meet Jesuses and Buddhas in human form here. And I truly believe that. I truly believe that I've come in contact with a lot of spiritual giants. And I stick to what they say because I know what I tell myself is no good. I have to listen to what they tell me. And, you know, if they tell me to sweep the streets of New York City, I do it because I know that's what they're looking out for my interest. And that's not something I had before. Before I came in here, I had nothing. I was miserable. I was alone. I just wanted to die. And I just, today I have a design for living. I have, you know, I mean, days are not perfect. And, you know, I can be unmanageable, but I call my sponsor and I call other alcoholics and they give me direction. That's all I need is direction. You know, I don't need a, you know, that's all I need is direction, you know, and, I just practice. One of the most important things I do each day, and to end this, is that I meditate in the morning because I need to clear my head of all this craziness. And the God of my understanding comes to me every day without fail. It doesn't abandon me. If you know you, God, this higher power will never, ever abandon you. It's here, and it will take care of you no matter what. And just to end this, you know, I'll take what Stacy said once. Just show up. No matter what happens in your life, just show up and it gets better and your life, you have a life beyond your wildest dreams. And like I said, I should be dead and I have a life. And that's just a miracle. Thank you.
Our second 10-minute speaker is Deanna.
Hi, I'm Deanna, and I'm an alcoholic. And I'm very grateful to be sober. I just celebrated my 15-year anniversary. And I say that because I am going to focus on my recovery, because I think that the ups and downs and the all-arounds of my recovery really illuminate my life more than what it was before. I earned my seat here in a very big way. I lost my family. I lost my marriage. I lost my career. And I pretty much almost lost myself. I didn't lose a lot of my belongings. I was lucky. But when I came in, I was sent to treatment. And luckily, I never picked anything up after that. When I first came in, the only thing I was concerned about was how to get my husband back, or how am I going to be taken care of, and how I'm going to survive. I had no connection between what was upstairs and what was in my heart at all. I was frantically scurrying around trying to just get by. I think I had a tremendously low bottom physically. At the end, for the last 6 months, I'd been drinking around the clock. I probably drank about a quart of hard liquor a day plus a bottle or two of wine. And I was shaking. I was sweating in the middle of winter. It was pretty bad. I'm losing my train of thought, but I come from a family that my parents were European, and they spoke with a heavy accent. And I come from the Midwest, and all I wanted back then was to be a normal American kid that assimilated. And that's exactly what I wasn't, because the minute my parents opened their mouths, people knew that I was from somewhere else. So I started drinking when I went to college. And I thought it was fun, it was social, and it was. I never had one drink. It was fun, so you sort of get high, you get drunk, whatever. when I finished graduate school, I thought, okay, now that I am a professional, what do you do after you come home from work? You have cocktails. And so my habit became daily very, very quickly. And it was the sophisticated thing to do, to go out with people after work and have drinks. And then I thought, well, if I wasn't going out with people, I drank at home. I mean, that's pretty sophisticated, you know, have wine, you know, cigarettes, and just this would go on and on and on. And probably within 3 months, I had crossed the line. But I knew nothing about alcoholism. My parents were doctors, and to them, they were medical doctors. To them, alcoholics were in the Bowery. So I kind of had the same thought. All I wanted was a good time. My career was sort of, you know, the whole objective was to go out there and have fun. I moved to New York, and I went to work on Wall Street, and again, the huge objective was to go and have fun, and I did. I met somebody, and it was a very nice person, and we got married, and his whole wish for me was do whatever makes you happy. At which point, I lost my job, and it was summertime, and what made me totally happy was to drink morning, noon, and night, and to just relax because I had been very stressed. So I got married to this wonderful person, and my life should have been blossoming. Instead, it started little by little caving in on me. And I started drinking a lot, more and more and more, to the point that he would say, "Don't you think you've had enough?" Which would, I would go into a rage. And when I was at home and this would happen, it wasn't a problem because I would stay in the kitchen and cook and clean all night. Not a big kitchen, but it's what I did. And I would hide wine glasses behind the toilet. And this continued on and on and on. When we would go on trips, I sort of had to watch it. But I remember on one of our last trips, I actually went to the liquor store and I bought booze and I hid it in my suitcase. And I don't know, I kind of sensed that something was off. Husband said he's going to leave. I was like, good, now I can drink. Last 6 months, I drank around the clock. When I came into this program, sort of for the first 3 years, I did what I was told because I didn't have anywhere else to go and I didn't know anything else. At my third year anniversary exactly, I remember I had been seeing a therapist, I had been in group therapy, I had been in aftercare, one-on-one psychiatry, plus the meetings. And I had a sponsor, and at my third anniversary, I was so despondent and so sad and unhappy that I just wanted to be hit by a truck. And somebody said to me, you know, I want you to meet this person because she'll help you out. Turns out that this person was half my age, she had half my sobriety, but she said, you know what, I'll take you through the book and I will help you, you will become happier. And I started coming to the Atlantic Group back then. And I did what she told me and I went through the steps. I didn't feel it, but you know what, we're told to act as if. And eventually what happens here goes into our hearts and into our beings. My life got busy then, and I got a job. A career started to take off. And I remember saying to this person, well, you know, I'm really ready for a relationship now. This is my favorite part. And she says to me, "You really? Yes, you are. Now you need a sponsee." And I was like, not quite. When I got my sponsee, I have to tell you that that is what started softening my edges, and that's what started bringing me into the human race, integrating me into the community, because what I said to her, I had to practice. I wanted to help her. I didn't want to be fired. It's like, oh, my God, you know, the whole world's fired me, every friend, relative, whatever. You know, I can't have, you know, someone here firing me. So I took a lot of care to cultivate this relationship and to try and be as sincere as I could. And I grew and I grew and I grew to be more loving, to be kinder. Lo and behold, I got a relationship. I met somebody that was in these rooms, and he and I were together for 6.5 years, and he got cancer. And he died 1 year and 2 months ago. We were no longer together at that time. But I have to say that after we broke up and he still had his cancer, there was nowhere else I wanted to be but to help him through, because I was the closest person to him. It wasn't his kids and it wasn't his ex-wife. Somehow it was me. And I was able to watch this person die and to take him through it, something that I never in a million years dreamed I could do. And I sat there, and that's where I wanted to be. And when he died, the rooms carried me. People helped me. And I kept coming to meetings. I kept sharing about it. And I had a lot of comfort, and I had a lot of people around me. And I prayed. And my God helped me. This was 1 year ago in November. Last June, I went on a spiritual retreat. I didn't know it was a big book study, but I went to the Bill Wilson House, and it was a big book study put on by the Atlantic Group. And I was thrilled to be there, but what really clinched it, and by the way, after my first stint at Atlantic Group, I stopped coming here, and basically the problem was is that I never really did a 10th step, so I wasn't current with where I was. And I had a lot of little things in me that were, like, annoying me. And that's why I wanted to come to this, because I needed to reconnect better with God and to start working more of a program. I came in, I'm there. This one guy, Kevin H., starts talking about the bedevilments. You know, if you're sitting in here, you know, you are sober, but if you're unhappy, you can't have a relationship, you're miserable, you're jealous, you're angry, you don't have to be that way. You can have more. And I was like, that's me. You know, I'm signed up. I'll take it. So since June, I have been coming here very, very regularly, and I got myself a sponsor who sees me through doing the program, and I have to do it. It's not a sponsor that's like, oh, you know, maybe. I have to do it every day. I have to pray. I have to report to her, Peggy, and I couldn't be happier about it. So I just want to say that I am eternally grateful to be sober, and thank you all.